multiple tribal members with disabilities on regaining, retaining, and securing employment, particular to their strengths, capabilities, and experience. Information at grandron.org or 1-800-242-8196. Now, Health Watch.
The purpose of this program is not to prescribe a treatment to individuals. Listeners should consult their healthcare practitioner before attempting any treatment.
Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Today's guest, Jane Hersey, is the national director of the nonprofit Feingold Association, which helps families identify foods and food additives that cause learning, behavioral, and health issues in children. A former teacher and Head Start consultant, Hersey has testified before the National Institutes of Health, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and Congress about the role of diet in the rise of ADHD. She's here today on Health Watch to talk about her book, Why Can't My Child Behave? Welcome to Health Watch, Jane Hersey.
Thank you so much, Dr. Naiman. I'm delighted to be with you.
So tell us, when in the title, Why Can't My Child Behave, what are some of the behaviors you're referring to in the book?
Well, you know, some of these children have extreme behaviors, but many of the children, I like to say they're like all other kids, only a whole lot more so. And in my experience, one of the major characteristics, and it just isn't just applying to children, it applies to adults as well, and that is that they have a short fuse. They get upset too easily. Now, they may have additional problems like distractibility or short attention span. They may be impatient, which my husband certainly fit into that category before we found the Feingold diet. Some of the children might be disruptive or aggressive, and then they might have various symptoms. It could be anything from night terrors, nightmares, bedwetting, being extremely sensitive to things like touch and sound, and lights. They could have frequent ear infections, asthma, hives, etc. The connection between certain food additives and these physical problems, such as asthma and hives, goes way, way back. You can look in the allergy literature back as far as the late 1950s and see links there. So it really is, in a way, it's very perplexing because a single food additive can affect different people in very different ways. And we have had experience with people with a huge number of problems. But I would say that the thing we focus on most of all is how things in our food affect the way we behave.
And in the beginning of the book, Jane, you say that good parenting techniques that are useful for most children are not useful for chemically sensitive children. Can you tell us more about what you mean by that?
Right. Well, you know, I tell people my little girl never read the book. She there were books that were had wonderful ideas about parenting, but they didn't apply. And I guess the best analogy I could use is if somebody has had too much alcohol, then gold stars are not going to mean a thing to them. So for these children, while they are under maybe a little extreme to say under the influence, but while they are reacting to some of the synthetic chemicals in their food, and keep in mind most of these chemicals are derived from petroleum, and while a child is having a reaction to a powerful chemical, they themselves are not able to control how they behave. And I don't see how you can modify the behavior of somebody who is not able to control their own behavior. You can't talk somebody out of being drunk, for example. So while my daughter was affected by things like food dyes, artificial flavor, certain preservatives, it didn't really matter what parenting skills I used. It really wasn't going to have any effect, and it didn't. But once I understood that she was being chemically affected, and I understood that psychological solutions don't work for chemical problems, and then I removed these offending chemicals, then she was able to control her behavior. She was able to behave in ways that were appropriate. and then the parenting skills, then the techniques were very good. But not while she was, you could almost compare it to somebody who is high on drugs. You're not going to get through to them until the offending chemicals are out of their system, and then it will work fine.
Tell us, Jane, about some of the offending chemicals that are common in our food supply that people might not be aware of or looking for in terms of food mood reactions.
Right. Well, you know, like most of the people in this country, I had no idea that things like food dyes and today that artificial flavors and some preservatives, I had no idea that those were derived from petroleum, which is crude oil, like what gasoline comes from. And I thought, well, you know, they came from berries or vegetables or something like that. And I also used to believe, well, if a food additive was harmful, then the Food and Drug Administration would never allow it to be put in our food. And I'll pause while people laugh, if you like. That was in the old days, and that was back when doctors were endorsing cigarettes. So I've learned a few things since then. The major additives that we focus on are our petroleum derivatives. We also focus on some of the worst of the synthetic sweeteners, things like aspartame and Splenda. But one of the biggies is the food dyes. And Dr. Feingold, who was an eminent physician in chief of allergy in Kaiser Permanente in San Francisco, he knew as an allergist that a person can be sensitive to virtually anything. But when you look at everything that's out there, if you have to select what seem to be the worst offenders and also the most unnecessary chemicals. This is why he came up with his list, putting food dyes, artificial flavors, and a couple of preservatives as the top of the list. These are the things he said, well, let's start with this. These seem to bother the most people. And also, when he did this work back in the mid-60s and early 70s, it was not only were people unaware that things you eat could affect your behavior, but believe it or not, back then, most people did not understand that the food you ate had a direct connection on your health. Now, today it seems ludicrous. Well, you know, duh, of course everybody knows that, but everybody didn't. And if you think about the fact that the 70s, it wasn't that far from the time that astronauts landed on the moon, and they brought dehydrated food-like stuff. Everything that was scientific and modern was romanticized. You know, this was anything new and modern was really cool. And so the sort of things that people had been eating for generations seemed very old-fashioned and fuddy-duddy. And so I, like many other people, thought, oh, well, let's see, you know, what the modern food industry, today I would say what the chemical industry, what the modern food industry has in store for us. And, you know, I wanted to be one of these modern homemakers with my convenience foods and all of this stuff. Well, modern is fine, but when you're eating stuff that isn't food, it causes trouble.
In case you just tuned in, you're listening to Health Watch, and we're talking today to Jane Hersey, the director of the nonprofit Feingold Association, about her book, Why Can't My Child Behave? Jane, so you mentioned the FDA and its lax oversight. Are there other countries that are banning some of these substances? And are there some studies that are more contemporary that are noteworthy to you that you would mention in terms of certain dyes or additives and their health effects?
Yes, there certainly are. And just a quick note about the studies. Our website, ADHDdiet.org, you can access a tremendous number of studies. There have been so many studies that have been done. But the one that has made the biggest splash across the pond, if I can be corny, is a study that was done in England, a study that took place there. And it was published in 2007. And what was a little bit unique about this study is that a large group of children, were given things like food dye. And what they found was that the ADHD symptoms were showing up not just in a select group of children who had the diagnosis ADHD, but virtually all of the children exhibited ADHD types of behaviors. Now, as parents in the Feingold Association, and we've been doing this work since the mid-1970s, we have had so much experience with so many thousands of families that it came as no surprise, but it did surprise the medical community. So here you have a very modest amount of synthetic food dyes and one preservative, sodium benzoate, being given to what I like to call regular kids, and they exhibited ADHD characteristics. So we know, and we have known this through our work with so many families, that the more of an additive you use, the more children are going to react to it, and the more you ingest, the more likely you are to have these problems. Now, this study was published in The Lancet, and it received a tremendous amount of attention worldwide, but particularly in England. And the British government, in effect, said to the manufacturers, now that we know that these dyes are so harmful, we want you to remove them from foods, because food additives don't have to be derived from petroleum. Manufacturers can, and some do, use colorings and preservatives and flavorings that are natural. They've been available for almost forever. People used to dye foods using things like carrot juice and grape juice, etc. So what the British government said to the manufacturers was, take these harmful chemicals out or we're going to start to legislate it so that you have to. And they did, the manufacturers did replace the synthetic dyes with natural, etc. And then this spread to the rest of Europe, and the European Union, the Parliament for the European Union, passed a regulation that if a food company were to use one of these dyes in their foods, that they have to put a warning label on the product. Now, no food company wants to have to warn consumers that eating the product could cause activity or attention problems in children, which was what the labeling would be. So what happened was these multinational companies changed the foods in Europe, and they replaced the synthetic dyes with natural dyes. The food doesn't really look much different. It looks the same, but it's certainly a whole lot healthier. And what we are saying here in the U.S. is, well, thank you very much, Hershey and Kellogg and Kraft and everybody else, Mars for the M&Ms, thank you for taking the dye out of the European versions. Now, how about the U.S. versions? You know, kids in the U.S. have reactions to these additives, too. It's not confined just to Europe. So to pursue this, we recently worked with Center for Science and the Public Interest, another nonprofit, and with change.org. So if you go to change.org and look for the petition, there's a petition to the Mars Company to take the synthetic dyes out of their M&Ms and replace them with natural dyes that don't create these problems, with the same natural dyes that they're using in the M&Ms that they sell in Europe. So we're very excited. We've had over 100,000 signatures in a relatively short time. So change.org has been working with us as well to let Mars Candy Company know that there are a lot of us who don't want to eat this stuff. So we're very excited about that.
Jane, we have a caller, so we're going to invite Leslie to ask a question. Leslie, you're on the air with Jane Hersey.
Hi, Dr. Hersey. Hello, doctor. I wanted to ask you, what are you saying to these thousands of doctors who have been prescribing Ritalin and Prozac for children due to their behavior?
Yeah, well, I think they mean well, but unfortunately, I think they're looking at the wrong thing. I think they should be, pardon me, I think they should be trying to figure out why a child is having a problem instead of just doing what is typical for the medical model, and that is look for the drug. This is years ago when my husband suffered from horrible migraine headaches. These were headaches that would last 3 or 4 days, and all he could do was lie in a dark room. And he went from doctor to doctor. And it didn't occur to us back then, and it didn't occur to any of the doctors to say, gee, I wonder why you're getting migraines. Each doctor did exactly the same thing and wrote a prescription for a painkiller. Now, we didn't have pets, and I have since learned that if you have a dog, for example, that appears to be sick and you take the dog to the vet, the first thing that he asks is, what are you feeding the animal? Now, you know, in retrospect, if my husband had gone to a veterinarian, he might have found a good answer to his migraines. But, see, when you take your child to a doctor, a traditionally trained doctor, you are taking him there with the assumption that the child has a medical problem, that there's something not working right with the child. Well, if humans could eat petroleum and thrive, that would be rather abnormal. So when you go, when you select the professional to whom you take your child, you're kind of making the diagnosis yourself. If you take your child to an allergist, he's going to look for allergies, which may be there because a lot of these children are allergic. If you take your child to a neurologist, he's going to look for neurological problems. Go to a chiropractor, he's going to look for spinal adjustment needs and stuff like that.
Jane, just let me jump in and ask a question here. If we have listeners who have children with behavioral issues and they want to see how much or little benefit from doing the Feingold diet is, they can't just reduce some of these things, correct? They have to actually eliminate them entirely in order to assess the effect of how much they're causing the problem. Can you walk us through how somebody doing the Feingold diet would do it?
Right. Yes, I'd be happy to. And when I first learned about this, I dabbled in it. I made a few little changes, and I thought, well, if I make a few changes, I should see a few improvements in my daughter's behavior. I saw nothing at all. And frankly, at that time, I felt overwhelmed, so I thought, oh, good, I don't want to do this anyway. But when I really did it, when I really took out not just most or part, but all of the offending additives, the change in my daughter was so fast and so dramatic that there was just no going back. Pardon me. And that was back in 1975 that I did that. And I am not somebody who likes to work any harder than I need to. I find using the program is unbelievably simple. We've been benefiting from it for so many years. Our grandchildren are benefiting. Our children certainly did. My husband hasn't had a migraine since 1975. So what I tell families, Dr. Naiman, is if you want to just remove some of the additives because you want to improve the health of your family and you just don't want to eat that stuff, that's fine. But if you have a child who's having problems or a family member who's having problems, give it a really careful try, and we really make it easy for you. It's not that difficult. For example, instead of buying one version of a cake mix, you buy a different version. Or instead of buying this mac and cheese mix with the yellow 5 and 6, you buy this mac and cheese mix with a natural coloring or without dye. So we do all that work. We show you how you can go to the supermarket and find the foods that you like, but in a much better version. So we do encourage people, give it a careful try. It isn't that hard. Do it for a couple weeks. What you're going to find is that you'll be eating food that's of a much better quality, and you'll probably decide that it tastes a whole lot better. I know that we went from really kind of junky tastes to food that I consider gourmet. Now, of course, I don't pay gourmet prices, but we eat real, natural, healthy food. We can have convenience foods. We can buy frozen foods. We can buy mixes, but we know which ones to buy because the association does this research and it publishes this information.
So, Jane, there was an interesting part of your book, Why Can't My Child Behave, around acetylsalicylic acid, how there's a subset of people who, if they remove the food additives and food dyes, they don't get enough benefit, and they need to also look at this other issue around this substance. Can you explain that a little bit to us?
Sure, I'd be glad to. This is the quirky part of the Feingold program. Most people, when they realize that these additives that we focus on are made from petroleum and sometimes from other very undesirable chemicals, it's not a big loss to give them up. But the quirky thing is this, that there are some foods and a few other items like aspirin and medicine with aspirin, there are some things that have a naturally occurring chemical that can be a real irritant for some people. And what I ask people is, when they're puzzled about it, because it is puzzling, I ask them if they've ever known anybody who gets hives when they eat strawberries. And they say, oh, yeah, yeah. Well, there's nothing wrong with strawberries. They're a very healthy food. But there is a chemical that grows in the plant. The plant actually creates this chemical. And this can be an irritant for some people. So some individuals just have to stay away from strawberries. And for another person, it could be apples. For another person, it could be grapes or tomatoes. Usually, a person is only sensitive to a few of them, maybe one or two of them. Many of our members are not at all sensitive to these things. We call them natural salicylates. So, but since some people are, what we encourage folks to do is, at the beginning of the program, get rid of the petroleum-based additives. And frankly, nobody needs them. You're not going to miss them. It's so easy to find alternatives that don't have them. But at the same time, we encourage you to run a test where you take away many of the common fruits and a few other foods. So, for example, if your child is accustomed to drinking apple juice, we would encourage you to replace the apple juice with pear juice, which is well tolerated. We encourage people to replace the salicylate foods with non-salicylate. So pears instead of apples, you can use pineapple instead of orange. You can use all the melons and bananas. And for some quirky reason, grapefruit, lemon, and lime are well tolerated, but oranges and tangerines are not. There's not a lot of research, certainly no new research, on salicylates and why they can be a problem for some people. But we know that a percentage, a fairly small percentage, of our members can have a real major problem with one or more of these things. So let's take them away at the beginning, see what happens, and then when you're doing well, you can start to reintroduce them. And the good news is, particularly for children, that if they stay away from these salicylates that they're sensitive to for a while, they usually can reintroduce them later on. So it's kind of a nuisance to have to go without apples and oranges and tomatoes for a while, but we guide you through it. And what I found with my family is that although I temporarily gave up some of the foods we liked, there were so many new foods that I normally hadn't used. And actually, we expanded our diet because we tried new things, and they became favorites very quickly.
And what are your thoughts on sugar? I know sugar isn't prohibited on the diet. Do you feel like it is involved in hyperactivity or behavioral issues in children?
I think it's involved only, well, let me restate that. There are a small number of children or a small percentage who don't do well with it at all. I think we find that most children, if they eat sugar in too great a quantity, they have problems. If they eat it on an empty stomach, they are likely to have problems. But having said that, sugar is not the big bad guy that most people make it out to be. If you think about it, people have eaten sugar for a long time, maybe not as much as they do today, but when I was a child back in the Stone Age, I ate plenty of sugar, and if you don't believe me, ask my dentist. But sugar isn't the big problem. The problem is that foods that are high in sugar tend to have things like artificial colors, artificial flavors, and certain preservatives. So when people say sugar makes him hyperactive, they often use the word sugar to mean sugary foods or candy. Well, the junk food in the supermarket Not too much of it has sugar. It has high fructose corn syrup, so we're not even talking about sugar. But what we find here at the Feingold Association is sugary foods are fine. Don't overdo them. Try to make sure the child's had a decent meal first, and then go ahead and enjoy it. Now, here's why sugar is very important, and treats and ice cream and cookies and those things are important in our program. The reason why is that we don't want a child to believe, or an adult for that matter, to believe that this is some sort of a punishment. There are a lot of pristine, pure diets out there where you get rid of processed foods, you get rid of all sugars, you get rid of desserts, et cetera, et cetera. Well, try to tell that to a 9-year-old. Okay, we're going to go on this diet, and you're not going to have any of the foods you like anymore. That doesn't exactly gain cooperation. So one of the main reasons why we like to be able to offer children sugary things is that we want them to buy into this and to want to do it. And it has worked very, very well. At the beginning of the program, they eat the foods that they normally would eat, but of course without the additives. Now, once the child's behavior and focus has improved, once things are going well, then you can start to gradually cut back and get healthier and healthier food. But gaining the child's cooperation is the key to the program being so effective. And these children, they know that they can turn down the lollipop that they get from the bank and mom will give them a natural one. They don't have to give up anything. And this is why we don't have a big problem with children cheating on the diet. We give them what they like. Now, as I say, once they're established on the program, then you can gradually start to cut back on the sugar, and the kids are fine with that. But diet that a child won't do is not going to help.
Sure. So, Jane, unfortunately, we don't have time to go into some of your other suggestions around supplements or other things that people could look at for childhood behavioral issues, but perhaps you can give the website again and
sure.
People can go there if they're looking for more information.
Oh, I'd be glad to give it. It's ADHDdiet.org, ADHDdiet.org, and we cover those issues on our website in my book. Yes, I wish we had more time because we have so much practical, useful information, and we love sharing it.
It was great having you on Health Watch today.
Thank you so much.
We are talking today with Jane Hersey, the National Director of the nonprofit Feingold Association, about her book, Why Can't My Child Behave? You've been listening to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Stay tuned for the rest of the Monday morning radio zine.
Listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. The time is coming up on just about 11:30. Up next, we are going to hear Kristen Yount speak with American labor organizer Bob Rossi, who went to Turkey to discover more about the fight for freedom and how it's affected the Turks and Kurds there. We're going to be hearing this instead of a promised recording from surviving Tuskegee Airmen speaking at Portland Community College, which was unfortunately lost. Here we are with Kristen Yount.
This is Kristen Yount reporting for KABU. On Friday, November 8th, I spoke with citizen Bob Rossi upon his return from a month-long visit to Turkey and northern Kurdistan. Last summer, citizens in Istanbul protested the decision by the city government to develop a city park. In October, Amnesty International published a report accusing the Turkish government of grave mistakes when it came to dealing with protesters. The report says that 8,000 people were injured and at least a few fatalities occurred. Authorities employed the use of 100 armored trucks and deployed 100,000 canisters of tear gas. Critics blame the Gezi protest and massive backlash on the part of the authorities as a lack of democratic policy. The war in Syria puts a strain on Turkey in a few ways. First, the country is inundated with 600,000 refugees. Also, the federal Turkish government started to build walls on Turkey's Syrian border, interrupting the daily interactions between Syrians and Turks. But it also divides the community of Kurds. Protests on both sides of the wall are met with harsh violence from the Turkish army. In Nusaybin, the mayor, Ayşe Gökhan, ended a 9-day hunger strike this past weekend. She started the hunger strike to protest the so-called